Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. When you use Angie for your home projects, you know all your jobs will be done well. From roof repair to emergency plumbing and more, done well. So the next time you have a home project, leave it to the pros. Get started at Angie.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no. So my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron and Sanofi to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark-colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.
Thy ticket, Lady Jennifer of Coolidge.
Well, many thanks, good sir. Heareth my Discover card.
They accept Discover at Renaissance fairs?
Yeah, they do here. Discover is accepted at the places I love to shop. Getteth with the times.
With the times?
You're playing the lute. Yeah, and it sounds pretty good, right?
Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. Based on the February 2025 Nielsen report.
It's January 7th, 2026, and I'm KNX News Special Correspondent Steve Gregory. Thank you for joining me for this special edition of the LA Local, brought to you by the LA Car Guy family of dealerships. The Palisades and Eaton fires are among the most devastating disasters to ever hit the Los Angeles area. And while those impacted by the devastation continue to rebuild and recover, behind the scenes, fire agencies are going through their own version of rebuild and recover. I was able to bring together the chiefs from the LA City and County Fire Departments, Angeles National Forest, and Cal Fire. Those agencies were on the initial attack of the fires of January 7th, 2025. Now, this is the first time all the chiefs have gathered in the same room to talk publicly about the fires. It was no easy task, and frankly, I didn't think I could pull it off, given all the lawsuits filed and criticism still being leveled against city, county, and state officials. But after review from legal counsel, we were able to agree on a date, terms, and a location. And full disclosure, because of the previously mentioned legal issues, there are 4 edits in this interview, totaling approximately 11 seconds. And the chiefs took a 5-minute break in the middle of taping. Now, let me be clear. If you're expecting shouting, finger-pointing, or any type of courtroom drama moments, then this is probably not the episode for you. This interview's mission was not to lay blame. Accountability, culpability, and liability, well, all those will ultimately be decided in a courtroom and through the investigative process. So here's After Action, Lessons Learned from the January Fires.
Welcome, gentlemen. It's really nice to have you all here. I really appreciate it. I want to start by introducing you to the audience. Chief Robert Garcia.
I'm Robert Garcia, the fire chief for the Angeles National Forest. I've been the fire chief on the Angeles since about 2015 and have spent about 30 years here on the Angeles fighting fire.
Excellent. Chief Maroney.
Yeah, I'm Anthony Maroney. I'm the fire chief of the County of Los Angeles Fire Department. I've been the fire chief since 2023, and I have almost 40 years on the LA County Fire Department.
Chief Tyler.
I am Joe Tyler. I am the fire chief and director of Cal Fire out of our Sacramento headquarters location, overseeing the entire state. I've been in this position since March of 2022 and been with the department since 1990.
And the newest member of the group, Chief Moore.
I am Chief Jamie Moore. fire chief for the Los Angeles City Fire Department. I've been with the department just over 30 years, and I oversee all 106 fire stations in the city of Los Angeles.
I want to start with January 2nd. That was when National Weather Service started putting out a lot of the big alerts, and LA City was pretty much first on scene, correct? I mean, you were the first one to start seeing those notices and seeing those alerts coming in.
Well, the National Weather Service was putting out these alerts, and I think all of our agencies were being notified of the anticipated weather and the anticipated wind conditions that were coming. But let me start by reminding you, we did have a fire on the early morning hours of January 1st, and that was the Lachman Fire. That was a fire in the Palisades Highlands, and LA City Resources responded to that fire, extinguished the fire, and basically started picking up a hose on the 2nd. Just as those wind warnings started coming out, they had extinguished the fire and were basically done with mop up and were moving on to continue protecting the rest of the city.
ATF is still looking at all of that, right?
Yes, as the ATF came to investigate the Palisades Fire, which erupted on the 7th of January, they determined that the cause of the Palisades Fire was a holdover fire from the Lachman Fire. That was a undetectable fire that was burning deep in the earth. It was wind tested over those next days. So as we started—
What do you mean by wind tested?
Well, as we started talking about these particulate dangerous situation, the winds were slowly starting to pick up. The Santa Ana winds, which are winds that come from the east and head west, and the area over the Palisades was being wind tested in the sense that it was as these winds started blowing over the terrain and coming towards the coast, it was pushing along the area of the burn scar there. With a holdover fire, when you get a deep seated fire like that, it's those winds that could actually cause it to stir back up. And that's something that we actually saw, which resulted in the Palisades Fire. So we had a report. They picked up the hose on the 2nd. We did have a report of a fire on the 3rd. Our resources responded out to the area. We believe that those were just ashes that were being stirred around because our fire companies walked the area. They did not determine that there was any fire. There was no actual visible fire. And then it continued to be tested for several days after that. That was what resulted with the fire on the 7th in the Palisades.
So talk about that then. You're getting these weather alerts coming in, and you say the area's wind tested. When do other agencies get involved, and how far did LA City Fire go before you had to actually call in resources?
Well, we initially responded to a fire on the 7th around 10 a.m. in Hollywood. And so we responded to that area. Some LA County resources assisted us with that fire. At 10:30, the Palisades Fire erupted. And as soon as we started responding to that, our initial request was for 20 fire engines. That was before any companies actually got on scene. As companies were responding to the Palisade Highland area, we were releasing companies from the Hollywood Fire. That's when we put out the request for additional resources. And that's where we saw agencies like LA County and all our outlying agencies start responding to assist us.
Talk about when you say engine companies or companies, what does that mean?
So a fire company is a fire engine with, in our case, four individuals on it, a captain, engineer, and two firefighters. And so we had pre-deployed resources throughout the city of Los Angeles in anticipation of these winds. And a lot of those pre-deployed resources had already committed to that Hollywood fire and then were responding to the Palisades fire.
I think a lot's been made about this pre-deployment. How do you determine where these engines are going?
So what we do is we have a weather call the day before. We work with the National Weather Service. We get the relative humidity of the area. We also look at the anticipated winds and we look at the temperatures. Something that we do when we have low relative humidity, winds 25 miles or greater, we start what we call a red flag no parking restriction in the area. And so in anticipation of this wind event, we had enacted a red flag no parking restrictions, which provides us access as firefighters. Now, keep in mind, we have a lot of areas in the city of Los Angeles that are wildland urban interface areas. Those no parking restrictions allow some of our fire engines to get into some of those areas where it's very narrow roads, steep terrain in the wildland urban interface area. So we had already enacted red flag no parking restrictions. We were anticipating the weather. We had the weather that was coming and the winds that were coming. And so we had used our weather matrix. We have since modified that matrix, and that's something we can talk about later on is from lessons learned. But we had pre-deployed resources, and we put them in various areas of the city of Los Angeles that we know are affected by the Santa Ana winds. Porter Ranch, areas of the Hollywood Hills, Palisades, and we strategically placed those resources in anticipation of a fire that might break out anywhere in the city of Los Angeles.
I think people, and you know, the main purpose of this program is to educate people on how the process works. And I don't think people understand how, when you say strategically place resources, what do you mean? And I mean, how do you determine what intersection you put an engine at or what part of town you put an engine at?
So we're limited by space because of the number of resources we put together. So in some cases, we'll put together a strike team, which is five fire engines or five apparatus. In other locations, we'll put task forces, which is three engines. And they'll have a common leader that will direct their operations, and they work as a team. So a lot of the times we'll strategically place them at fire stations that have larger lots. And we place them in areas that we know that the winds have historically had fires and pushed those fires in dangerous situations. So that's how we determine where we're going to put those fire engines and how we're going to strategically place them throughout the city. They can be anywhere from Baldwin Hills, Hollywood Hills, Brentwood, all the way up into the Palisades.
At what point did county get involved?
As soon as we started deploying to, well, as I mentioned, we had resources from the county because they do protect our neighboring West Hollywood area. They responded to our Hollywood fire. But when we put out the request for 20 additional engines, the request went to LA County Fire for their assistance in the Palisades fire.
Okay, so so I understand. So when you put out a request, were you, at this point, was your agency too overwhelmed to handle that on its own?
No, we have a mutual aid system that allows us the opportunity to be able to reach out to our partners and request for their assistance in situations like this, in anticipation of knowing that we were going to be committing at least 20 fire resources to this fire, we requested assistance from LA County Fire.
Okay. And then how does that work? You request assistance from county, and then county, how do you handle it from there, Chief Maroney?
Yeah. So on the morning of January 7th, LA County, I am the Region 1 coordinator for fire and rescue.
And what does that mean?
It's I coordinate the five counties, Orange County, Los Angeles County, Ventura, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara, for mutual aid resources from the fire and rescue system.
Okay.
That's administered by state OES. So LA City is the head of operational area A. Those are four fire departments. It's LA City Fire, Santa Monica, Culver City, and Beverly Hills. When Chief Kristen Crowley realized that they had two fires burning in the city of Los Angeles on the morning of January 7th, she reached out via text to myself, Chief Fennessy from Orange County, and Chief Dustin Gardner from Ventura County, and said, hey, we have two significant fires in the city of Los Angeles. Please send some assistance. So LA County, we responded at a first alarm brush assignment from our stations in the Santa Monica Mountains to the Palisades fire. Even though that fire was located outside of the initial action zone, the automatic aid area that we have with the city, we knew with the strong winds and this PDS, this particularly dangerous situation, that any wildfire was going to be difficult to contain. So we sent the city assistance early in an attempt to extinguish that fire because we knew if we couldn't put the fire out, LA County lands would be threatened. And that was the Sunset Mesa area, the Big Rock area, and then eventually into Malibu.
You're working together now, and how bad is the fire at this point?
When we first arrived on scene, the initial engine company reported 10 acres in the area where the Lockman fire had already burned, 10 acres already engulfed with 90 to 100 mile an hour wind gusts. They were reporting ember casts that were well over their heads.
Explain an ember cast.
So an ember cast is products that are being burnt that haven't been fully consumed, that are being pushed by the wind. And depending on how strong those winds will determine how far those ember casts or those that burning material will go. A lot of people look at fires or see video of fires, and it looks like almost like a sparkler flying through the sky. They're extremely hot embers that are being exacerbated by the wind, and that wind's making them even hotter. And so when they land on something, especially when you have the conditions that we had, so keep in mind that from the 2nd all the way to the 6th, the entire area was very dry. We had low relative humidity, and everything was primed to burn. I mean, it was almost like pouring gasoline all over the fields that were in the area, including the structures. And so when these embers land on vegetation or they land on any type of combustible material, they're going to ignite. And so as fire companies were responding to this, the heel of the fire, where the fire actually had ignited, they had ember casts traveling over their head. And so they knew that this ember casts were going into the structures and recognized immediately that they were going to need to do something to protect those structures.
How far can those embers fly?
In this case, it was 3 miles down the road.
So, and I think, again, I don't think people understand that as well. That's how come you get all these like spot fires and these other fires all over the place. It seems so random.
Exactly. And it is random. It's wherever that wind is pushing those embers and where they land and what they land on. That's why when we talk about home hardening and having defensible space around your home is so important. Because if you have combustible materials around your home, they're going to ignite. If you use combustible materials to build your home, it's going to ignite. That's why we talk about screens and putting screens over the vents, because your home breathes. And as it's breathing, it'll actually suck the air from the outside into the attic. And that's what we were starting to see. You had large homes in the Palisades that were actually having ember casts go into the attic spaces. And so as firefighters were approaching to put out this fire and extinguish this fire, we had structures that were catching on fire that were behind them, that were downwind from them, that were headed towards the west because of these ember casts and where they were landing on their on the structures.
And see, Eaton Fire then was coming up pretty quickly after that, right?
Well, yeah, almost 8 hours later at 6:18 p.m. on Tuesday, January 7th.
And then that was your jurisdiction, right? That would be county.
Correct. It started in the county area. However, we did have three different fire departments respond. We had our partners from the Angeles National Forest, the U.S. Forest Service, in addition to the Pasadena Fire Department.
At what point then, Chief Moore, were you at that level of, this is not getting any better, this is getting worse?
I think it was early on in the fire. We had companies that were trying to make it up Palisades Drive. We had individuals who were trying to evacuate, self-evacuate. We had a lot of congestion on the Palisades Drive, and at one point, people exited their cars because of the fire traveling so quickly. Ember casts had traveled all the way down into the, that portion of the Palisades. We had roadsides that were catching on fire because, again, the fuels were so primed, and individuals panicked. They got out of their cars, and they started running down towards the ocean. In doing so, it caused congestion on our access, and apparatus were having a very difficult time going up as vehicles were trying to come down. At that point, I think we quickly realized that this was an abnormal situation. This was not something that we normally have. These are hurricane type gusts of wind, and our firefighters were extremely challenged with what they were facing. They were trying to get access. They were trying to evacuate the homes that were near the vicinity of the base of the fire. Plus, they had spot fires that were breaking out all over the Palisades Highlands, and they were trying to extinguish those spot fires. These homes were relatively large-sized homes. So with embers getting up into the attic spaces or getting into the foliage around them, they didn't recognize a fire until it actually started really burning on those homes. And our firefighters were tasked immediately with trying to put out structure fires, but yet fight a wildland urban interface fire.
So Chief Maroney, did you pre-deploy resources as well? Had you been doing that? So talk about how you did it and how you determined that.
Yeah, we actually did two things at the LA County Fire Department. We augmented our staffing. So we increased the normal staffing that we were going to have on duty on January 7th. We did that the day before on Monday. We finalized that plan. And then we also pre-deployed. We had our partners from CAL FIRE sent two strike teams to LA County, two Type 3 engine strike teams that were up in the Santa Clarita Valley area to assist us. So we leaned on our partners at CAL FIRE for assistance. And then we augmented our staffing. But one of the things that happened that morning was I got a call from our chief deputy, John O'Brien, and he sort of made the call on the fly that we needed to hold our off-going crew. So we have about 900 firefighters that staff 176 fire stations. Chief O'Brien thought that it was prudent to hold the off-going crew, to recall them, to force them to stay at work for 24 hours and staff the remaining reserve equipment that we had. So that was Type 1 engines, Quints, Type 3 engines, Type 6 engines, some battalion chiefs.
Explain what those mean. When you say Type 1 engines and Type 6 engines.
Yeah, we in California, we type our resources for the staffing level that's on that resource and the amount of water that resource holds.
Okay.
And the type of fire engine is it. Is it an urban fire engine or is it a fire engine for the wildland? Is it a Type 1 or a Type 3? It was a great call that Chief O'Brien made. I approved that. We held our off-going crew. So we went from 900 member staffing to 1,800 member staffing at 8 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday the 7th before any of the fires started in preparation. I think one of the stories that hasn't been told is David Gomberg and his team from the National Weather Service in Oxnard, they identified that the weather system was setting up to be this extreme red flag, not a regular red flag event, but an extreme red flag. And they call that a PDS. In 2020, the National Weather Service coined a new term for these extreme red flag events called particularly dangerous situations. And they put out the notification that January 7th was going to have life-threatening and destructive winds. And they were 100% correct. You know, in Los Angeles, we've never experienced a fire in our recorded history that was that severe. We had actually four fires that broke out that day, the Sunset Fire, the Palisades Fire, the Eaton Fire, and the Hearst Fire. Obviously, the Eaton and the Palisades were the most destructive fires, but the National Weather Service called it correctly. This was a PDS. This was life-threatening and destructive, and that's exactly what that day turned into.
How do you balance the resources, though? Because you still had resources helping out city, right?
So yes, we did.
How do you ensure that you have enough resources to go into the Eaton fires and the other fires?
Well, we did do that. So we also have to cover our jurisdiction.
Right, and you still
for
have
the
other,
1,200
yeah,
calls
you still
that
have
we
other
get
fires, right.
daily. We had a lot of stations that were vacant. Many of our stations had reduced staffing because we had resources both at the Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire. And then we sent even more resources at 10:30 p.m. to the Hearst Fire in the city of Los Angeles.
Which agency came in first from outside? Was it CAL FIRE or Forest Service?
For which fire?
For Eaton Fire.
For the Eaton Fire, it was L.A. County, the Forest Service, and Pasadena responding simultaneously. Then we were aided by CAL FIRE.
So, and then how does that work with the feds then, Chief Garcia? Then when you get a call or a request for assistance, how do you know how many resources to deploy?
Yeah, so for the time of alarm decision, that's a predetermined decision based on conditions in our dispatch system that determines these conditions, we send this kind of response. The area we're talking about, Eaton Fire, is an initial action zone with Los Angeles County, Angeles and Pasadena, where we all automatically respond into there at the first report. And so upon arrival, because of the location, our field commanders went into unified command, essentially while en route. As soon as they arrived physically together, they went into a unified command situation where they established common objectives, and common priorities, and then they assign assets from any of the agencies towards those objectives, regardless of jurisdiction, wherever the highest priorities are. And this kind of speaks to the preposition piece in the sense that we look at areas to place things. Oftentimes for us on the federal side, it's if we're well-staffed and we're prepositioned ahead of an event, it's really a logistical kind of a decision where to put those resources, meaning if our stations are all staffed for initial attack, the resources on preposition are for surge or for immediate backfill should those assets be dispatched. And in this case, we had local resources via mutual aid to Los Angeles City purely on a mutual aid basis where we didn't have a mutual threat. We just provided assistance through the ordering system, the geographic ordering system, sent to Palisades, as well as resources that we were backfilling to cover stations. So we had a pretty robust response to Eaton. In fact, our battalion chief ordered a second alarm while en route. So essentially, before any of our units got on scene, basically doubled the response to the Eaton fire.
Explain what a second alarm is.
Yeah, so we have a predetermined number of assets, number of engine crews, number of hotshot crews, hand crews, aircraft, dozers, and essentially it's a pre-planned response to an ignition. And then we have a second alarm, third alarm that pre-identifies what that would be.
So the higher the number, obviously, the more resources are coming in.
Yeah, essentially it doubles what the first alarm run of assets would be.
And why did your battalion chief order that en route? He already knew, or she already knew, that it was going to be that bad?
Yeah, by that time, shortly after 6 p.m. In the evening, by that time, the winds had surfaced at a pretty broad scale. Chief Maroney talked about the eastern San Gabriels and what the wind was like there. And by that point in the afternoon, we were all monitoring all the activity, Palisades activity, obviously with resource mobilization, responding to other calls of trees down, power lines down, you know, that kind of wind-related activity. But it was apparent that based on the conditions that we were in, based on the fire behavior that was being observed, the explosive fire behavior on Palisades, that once we had a confirmed fire and based on the location, that it was going to be an extremely challenging, extremely high resistance to control if we were going to be successful at all in terms of containing that fire.
And so you also assisted on the Palisades?
We provided mutual aid resources.
As well. And so how were your resources spread out? Were you spread thin?
At that point at Eaton, we were still at a pretty optimal initial attack level. We also augmented staffing, our local staff, our local firefighters. We staffed additional resources. We had a fair amount of mutual aid resources that were on pre-positioned. So we also had strike teams, crews, dozers, aircraft, in addition to our local staff that were brought down from points north of Kern County, essentially.
So Chief Tyler, on the CAL FIRE side, obviously you've got stations that are down here because you service some unincorporated areas and you've already got staffing down here.
Right.
Pre-deployment's a big thing and a lot's been made about it. Talk about your pre-deployment strategy with the Palisades incident.
No, I appreciate that. And so I want to go back in just a little bit of time, if you don't
sure.
mind. And that is, you know, as we started recognizing the red flag conditions were going to occur across Southern California, there were conversations between Chief Maroney and I over the telephone that he called me and he said, if we have a fire, we're going to deploy one of your incident management teams to that fire. And I'll describe what that is here in just a little bit. But some of the strategy that we place, you know, I think we have to look at the state of California and the mutual aid system as a whole. And we see Southern California is made up largely of paid professional career fire departments. As you start moving north across the state, you start finding yourself in a combination of departments where you have paid professionals and volunteers. And then as you go further north to up into Siskiyou County at the far north end of the state, you find yourself largely volunteer fire departments, some paid professionals, some combination departments. Overlap that with CAL FIRE, who has 21 operational units across the state, 6 contract counties, one of those being the Los Angeles County Fire Department, where we all work together. You know, what I pride myself with as part of this department is, and our federal partners are the same way, is we constantly move resources up and down the state depending on where the critical fire weather condition is at the time. And so as we led into these red flag conditions in knowing that they were coming January 3rd and 4th, having these conversations, by January 5th, we had made the decision to staff all of our southern region units, nine units, I'll describe that as well, that we're going to staff all of their frontline engines, all the reserve engines, all of their hand crews 24 hours a day. Now imagine those counties being almost every county south of an imaginary line from Lake Tahoe to Monterey, anything south of that. They were staffing up all of their resources, but we hadn't necessarily moved them. Now, as part of that strategy, as we continued on, we moved 45 fire engines and six hand crews into Ventura, San Luis Obispo, Riverside, Orange County, San Bernardino, Los Angeles, and San Diego counties. Now, as said earlier, a lot of those decisions about moving those resources are, where can we stage these individuals, all of these fire apparatus, where can we house them? And many times we will place these resources in places of major intersections where they can move west, east, or south. Later in these incidents, we actually established, and it's not very common, the state does this, we established a mobilization center in Beaumont, California, here, where people said, why did you stage so many resources east of the Los Angeles Basin? Well, that was to keep them out of the Los Angeles Basin so they could go north, south, east, or west. It is a strategy that we all use to be able to move resources, have them available across the state.
So if you did that, were those resources used on during those days or not used?
So the resources, the 40...
Once you had down in Beaumont.
Yeah, okay, so the resources that we sent to Beaumont, they did get dispatched to the Palisades Fire, the Eaton Fire, the Border Fire, which occurred in San Diego County, the Lilac Fire that was on the north end of San Diego County as well. And one of the things we did with this mobilization center was we would send resources. We would have plenty of resources staged. We would send resources to the fires. And then when the resources later in these fires were no longer needed, but the fire activity still existed, those resources would come back to the mobilization center until there was determined that there was no longer a need, and then they were released back home. Now, this mobilization center held resources not only from within the state of California, but across the entire West, states, other countries deployed resources that would go into this mobilization center as well.
And does that go, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, just to tag on to what Chief Tyler said. So just for your listeners, the county of Los Angeles is the most populous county in the United States. 10.1 million people. It's over 4,000 square miles. When it comes to wildland firefighting, the LA County Fire Department really leans on its partners, not only Cal Fire, but also the U.S. Forest Service for resources, because not every municipal fire department has wildland firefighting resources, hand crews, dozers, and aircraft. So we really do appreciate the assistance that not only the U.S. Forest Service, but Cal Fire provides, because it's a huge responsibility to respond to wildfire in Los Angeles County. And we had four fires that day. I've already gone through them. It was the Sunset, the Palisades, the Eaton, and the Hearst. But I want your listeners to recognize that we had a fire siege in Los Angeles County. It started on January 7th, and it ended on January 22nd. We had 12 separate fires, culminating in the Hughes Fire on January 22nd that burned 10,000 acres that started in the Angeles National Forest. We had a period of time. It was a very difficult period of time, that 15-day period, over 2 weeks. And we were just going, you know, from fire to fire to fire. Like Chief Tyler said, they had the MOB Center in Beaumont. They were pushing resources into Los Angeles County and the other counties in Southern California. This was one of the most significant, challenging events that the LA County Fire Department and our partners have ever responded to.
And as Chief Maroney mentioned, we do, the city of Los Angeles relies heavily on our partners as well. And that's one of the lessons we learned from this. I mean, when we look back at the lessons learned from this Palisades fire, we've since instituted a hand crew program in the city of Los Angeles. It's important to mention that the winds were so bad, these gusts of winds were so powerful that all of our aircraft was grounded. Mm-hmm. We had our initial water drops were within 10 minutes of the Palisades fire erupting. We had hand crews that were out, or firefighters on hand lines that were out there within those initial moments of that fire erupting. But the terrain was so steep, there was nothing that they were doing to be able to stop this fire. Those winds were pushing this fire so fast in the direction of the Palisades. There was no way that the resources we had augmented and pre-deployed from the city of Los Angeles could have done anything to stop that. We relied heavily on our mutual aid partners from not only just LA County, but other agencies throughout the state of California to assist us. And it wasn't really until the winds subsided that we were able to make some headway and start combating these fires and getting control of the situation. And as Chief Maroney mentioned, this went on for days because of these wind conditions.
So Chief Tyler, you were talking about resources that were coming in from all over the West and all over the country or around the world. Those resources go through you? Do they check in with you, or how does that work? How do they get the call to come in?
So there are multiple facets, and one of our partners that aren't here today are from Cal OES, the Fire and Rescue Division of that department. Chief Maroney talked about being the coordinator for Region 1. There are 6 OES regions across the state. That's important because what happens is, depending on where the resources are ordered from, there are numerous ways in which they can get into the state of California. They can be ordered by Cal Fire through the state ordering system. They can be ordered by Cal OES through the local government ordering system and the emergency management compact system. They can be ordered by Chief Garcia's agency under the federal ordering system. Now, that seems like multiple ordering systems as a way to get resources into the state of California. That is the region. That is the reason in 2 areas of the state of California. One is in Riverside. One is in Redding. There is a coordination center. That coordination center has local, state, and federal chief officers, command and control officers in the same room at the same time who are coordinating all of these orders and getting them out. I talked about the 45 engines that Cal Fire itself moved, but it is important, as we talked about pre-positioning and pre-deployment, that our Cal OES partners also fund, at the request of local government across the 6 regions, the ability to pre-deploy and for Cal OES to pay for the pre-deployment of those resources as well. So the discussion about whether there were 45 state engines or whether there were over 100 pre-deployed engines by the state, well, that is a combination of the 45 engines that Cal Fire provided and the additional engines through paid pre-deployment that Cal OES provided as well. You know, if you don't mind, there's a couple other myths that I want to talk about here that became big in the early days. One was that resources that we were ordering from across the West were going into Sacramento, California for emissions testing. That is blatantly false. What we did do is we brought resources into Sacramento into our mobile equipment center. No resource was there for more than 30 minutes. They were inspected, and many times brake pods, brakes, suspension systems were replaced on these out-of-state resources so they could safely travel to Southern California to be able to get into the firefight.
And we're going to talk a bit about myths a little bit later as well. But I want to ask the question, who's in charge this whole time? Who's calling the shots? Let's go with Eaton Fire. Who's in charge over there?
The Unified Incident Commanders. So at the Eaton Fire, we had not only LA County Fire, but also LA County Sheriff. We had the U.S. Forest Service, the Angeles National Forest. We had the fire and police departments from Pasadena, Arcadia, and Sierra Madre. It's unified command. It's not one single person being in charge. Because the geographic locations that are being affected by the fire are multiple, you're going to have multiple incident commanders. They come together under the Unified Command umbrella to come up with a common set of operating procedures, a common set of strategies and priorities. That's what unified incident commanders do. They do it for the benefit of the incident. And what it means is that LA County resources, LA County fire resources, can go into Sierra Madre or Arcadia or Pasadena, and outside agencies can come into LA County. We're not beholden to our jurisdictional areas. LA County resources just don't remain in LA County. Pasadena doesn't stop fighting the fire when they go across that jurisdictional boundary. It allows us to all work together as a team and be stronger and deploy resources where the fire is hitting at that time. That's one of the concepts of unified command, is you can come in from outside an area and do work in somebody else's area.
And then,
Chief Maroney described that beautifully in terms of how the operational assets come together. You know, ICS was born here in Southern California from these types of disasters, right? It's a model nationally.
Incident command
system, mm-hmm. right? The ICS system. And much like the mobilization that Chief Tyler was describing in terms of mob center staging, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about pre-positioning, but it serves different purposes, whether it's local initial attack, whether it's surge capacity, whether it's providing our assets some relief to get some firefighters rest so that we can keep the mission going. But as that seems like complexity, I hope what the listeners understand in terms of mobilization system is that it helps us leverage every bit of authority, every bit of resources, every bit of assets at all different levels of government. So a mobilization system like what Chief Tyler was describing as a surge, a matter of surge capacity. Chief Maroney mentioned the Hughes fire, and that's a prime example of where that provided us immediate surge for multiple phases of that incident as a model that we had essentially, to your point about who's in charge, a theater of operations, and each incident has a commander. And yet the enterprise level risk that all of our agencies are facing in a situation like that, a fire siege that essentially is a theater of operations with coordination from our GACs, our geographic area coordination centers. But really the idea there is to leverage and tap into assets that all of our organizations can provide.
I'm assuming, obviously, Chief Moore, that the exact same thing is going on over at Palisades.
The exact same thing was going on at the Palisades, but it was also going on at the Hearst fire as well. And understand that when we are in unified command, it's not just fire agencies that are unified. It's also law enforcement agencies as well. I can tell you, having been the incident commander of the Hearst fire, it was myself, LA County, and the Angeles National Forest that were unified in fighting that fire. And that was the fire that previously had burned in the Sylmar area, where we'd lost hundreds of mobile homes. Mm-hmm. So we were able to combat that fire, evacuate the area, and keep that fire at a minimal. We only had two structures that were damaged on that. But fortunately, we had resources available to us that were committed to that area, knowing what was going on in the Palisades. So we committed all our resources we could to the Palisades, but as that fire broke out, we had requested so many additional resources from our mutual aid partners that we had other resources that we were able to use when that fire broke out later that evening.
Open question. Were there enough resources to handle what was going on between all the fires that were going on during those few days?
Not in the first 3 days.
Not on January 7, 8, or 9.
Not at all.
No?
Yeah, absolutely not. No, we were completely outpaced. We were overwhelmed. I said that at the first One Voice press conference on the morning of January 8th. We could not keep up with that unprecedented ember cast that Chief Moore talked about. Our firefighters were completely outpaced by the speed with which this fire traveled. I mean, if you look at the Eaton fire, a little bit over 14,000 acres, damaged or destroyed upwards of 9,000 structures, took the lives of 19 people, all within probably a 24-hour period. The speed with which this community conflagration occurred was unprecedented. I think of Lahaina. I think of the fire in Paradise, the campfire. You know, it's not lost on any of us as fire chiefs that over the last 11 years, we are being challenged with more difficult and destructive fires that happen outside what is our traditional fire season. You know, the Palisades and the Eaton started in January. We typically don't get large life loss destructive fires in January. And, the climate is certainly changing. 23 to 25 is going to be on record throughout the world as the three hottest years in recorded history. Things are changing, and there's new risks and challenges that are emerging every day. And it's our responsibility as fire chiefs to make sure that our departments learn, act, and improve so we can be better next time. Hindsight's 2020. We've looked at, through after-action reviews, what occurred. We have lessons learned, and we have initiatives that we have to implement because, you know, we've taken an oath to protect not only our citizens, our residents, but also property and the environment.
So let's talk real quick about the pre-deployment, because I think a lot has been said about that. And I think the general public and those who lost homes and those who were impacted, I think, feel like there were not enough resources deployed to those areas. And every agency's been kind of dinged about pre-deployment. What would you say to those people that felt like there were not enough resources, apparatus, whatever you want to say, there were not enough of those there?
I can say on behalf of the city of Los Angeles, we recognize we didn't have enough resources, and that's one of the biggest takeaways. We've since modified our deployment matrix based on these particularly dangerous situations and anticipation of what we would need in the future. We've reviewed our recall procedures. As Chief Maroney said, they made a last-minute call to augment their staffing and hold over their resources. We did not do that. In hindsight, do we wish we had? Absolutely. We could have staffed all of our additional pumps had we done that. Would that have enabled us to be able to fight this fire and had a different outcome? No. As we mentioned earlier, we didn't have enough resources, but even if we had had the resources that we had the second, third day, that initial moment, unless we had them strategically sitting there waiting for this fire to erupt where it erupted, there's no way that we could have been able to combat this fire. It was dangerous. Our firefighters were extremely brave in doing what they did to initiate the attacks that they did. And unfortunately, we combated this fire to the best we can. And unfortunately, 12 lives were lost. And we are deeply sympathetic to the fact that we lost any lives whatsoever and the number of structures we lost. This is a very difficult thing for our firefighters to handle. They're not used to loss. They're not used to engaging in a firefight and walking away having been beaten the way they were. And Mother Nature took its toll. And our firefighters are recovering from it, but we're learning what we can from this and changing the things we need to change. And that includes our deployment models. It includes using technology to anticipate where the fires might travel. Improving our radio communications and looking at our deployment strategies as to where we're going to place them in the future.
You want to add?
Yeah, on behalf of the LA County Fire Department, I'm proud with our augmentation and our pre-deployment that we had leading into January 7th. I thought it was going to be enough to double our workforce and staff all of our reserve equipment. However, in retrospect, we could never have enough. Because if you have an event where 16,000 structures are damaged or destroyed and 31 lives are taken by the fires, we just simply don't have enough resources to attack every one of those fires. Even if we had one engine for every fire, that would be 16,000 engines. We only had 1,600 engines in total at the height of this response to this fire siege period. We had over 11,000 firefighting personnel in Los Angeles County over that 15-day period. And what I think it speaks to is we have to do a better job and we have to focus more on preparation and prevention It's not the response. It's what we do before the response that's going to save lives in the future. So that's managing our fuels and our forests better, making sure that we have better defensible space around structures, and having some form of home hardening and zone zero that's going to allow a structure to be standalone and not need a fire truck in front of it to prevent it from burning down. We really need to focus on the before, not the actual response. It would be easy for me as a fire chief to say, I need more firefighters, I need more fire trucks, I need more fire stations, but I'm not sure that that's actually going to address the problem. We have to focus on prevention and preparedness.
You want to add?
So for CAL FIRE, as I described earlier, we are a broad state. And so one of the criticisms that we received was prior to January 7th, we downstaffed some of our resources in Northern California. Now, the traditional fire year has clearly extended by about 78 days, science says. And we recognize that across Northern California, those counties in Cal for, related to CAL FIRE are funded right now till October 1st and October 15th. Now, we held those resources till November 1st. Northern California was receiving significant rain and snow at that time, and a decision was made because we were holding those resources longer than they were funded for to downstaff those resources to base staffing, meaning there is still staffing, there are still permanent employees, but the seasonal employees were released across Northern California. Now, across that imaginary line that I described from Lake Tahoe to Monterey, everything south of that remained staffed, and we staffed further, as we talked about, in those staffing patterns or those pre-deployments that we talked about. And that was a good thing. It was able to move those resources. We recognize that the legislature and the administration have grown CAL FIRE significantly in the last 10 years, and we are in a multi-year phased-in approach, 3 years left, to add nearly 3,000 additional firefighters, not additional fire engines, but additional firefighters into the system. That's going to give greater capacity to be able to move resources. I wish I had them prior to January 1st. I don't, but we're making efforts to move forward to make sure that we have more resources into the future able to respond to large and devastating fires across the state.
So, but to my initial question was, you know, to the public, they felt like there were not enough resources from CAL FIRE. I mean, that was a criticism as well. So, I mean, what would be your answer to that?
So my answer really for your listeners to that is by January 8th, all of those Northern California resources, many of them were all moving to Southern California. We were recalling all of the permanent employees. We were rehiring our seasonal employees to bring them back as well.
Got it.
I'll just add some context. I mean, obviously, in looking at this incident and different engagements where life and property are at risk, and even with the robust pre-positioning with resources from out of state and at different parts of the state, including aircraft, you know, we had probably triple the number of aircraft we would normally have on in January, and they couldn't fly. And our firefighting tactics for a wildland fire, facing down this scenario where resources that are designed for specific tactical engagements, hand crews to contain the perimeter of the fire for hours, if not for the first 24 hours, could not find tactical advantage to engage for perimeter control of fire, right? Their mission was to protect life and assist with protecting their property. But so thinking about the use of resources, and I think at any given time, there was periods of time where we needed more resources, either to backfill, to provide the ongoing continuity of operations and continuation of services, because we're breaking new fires throughout this whole thing, right? But also to provide relief for firefighters. So it's not purely on a preposition that a fire truck on every block to respond that quickly. It's also these other aspects of it. But from a standpoint of the hurricane force winds on the Eaton fire, the weather phenomenon, we talked about the weather service, Most folks don't know that we had snow in Wrightwood the morning that the Palisades fire started. The weather dynamic and the rapid onset, the mountain wave that occurred was pretty tremendous in terms of historical context and firefighting experience across 30, 40 years of the rapid onset of the winds. And so that dynamic, can we use more resources at any given time? Sure. But also with some context, there was periods of time where our resources couldn't fly, our firefighters couldn't even get in there to make an attack safely.
Yeah, and actually we were fortunate in the beginning hours of the Palisades fire because we had a significant number of helicopter resources and fixed-wing retardant tankers operating from the start of the fire at 10:30 all the way till sundown. However, as the sun went down, the wind speeds picked up, and we started getting those, you know, those hurricane force winds, category 1 and 2 hurricane force winds, 90 to 100 miles an hour at night. Unfortunately, we were unable to use our aircraft at night on the Eaton fire. We fought the Eaton fire completely from the ground. We were blinded. We didn't have our eyes in the sky telling us where the fire was moving so we could pivot resources from one area to another. Not having aerial resources at the Eaton fire made it tremendously difficult for our unified incident commanders to know exactly where the fire was moving and when. And that was a huge challenge for us. In addition to the smoke that was laying low to the ground, this unprecedented ember cast that we were experiencing at the Eaton fire, we had power lines down that were also starting fires in addition to the embers that were landing adjacent to structures. The Eaton fire was the most devastating fire, most difficult to contain that the LA County Fire Department has ever responded to in our 102-year history.
Let's talk lessons learned here. After-action reports have come out, and I understand there's still other after-action reports due in the coming months. But I pulled here some of the most general ones that were out of all of the after-action reports. But I want to go around the room and ask each agency what your lessons learned were. Chief Moore.
For the Los Angeles Fire Department, I think having experienced the devastation and loss from the Palisades fire, the key lessons learned include the importance of pre-deployment for such anticipated weather conditions. We've, as I mentioned earlier, modified our pre-deployment matrix for particularly dangerous situations so that we have the augmented staffing, pre-deployed resources, and using other available resources like OAS to assist us in pre-deployment of those anticipated conditions. But we also have since modified our mop-up procedures to include the use of drones. We have now, since this fire, have 15 certified drone operators and 10 that can do thermal mapping, amongst other things. We have 10 drones that we can use, and we actually utilize them post-fire as part of the mop-up procedures. The importance and effectiveness as proper cold trailing. We have since hired on a hand crew of young adults that can go out there and actually help us with the containment and mop-up procedures after a fire, like the Lockman fire. We're also requesting additional resources in our budget, another crew, the use of our heavy equipment operators post-fire, but also the augmentation of another helicopter, and that's what we've added into our budget. We've improved the use of technology. Zone mapping is part of it, and so that we can anticipate the travel of the fire much earlier, and the importance of our fire weather monitoring systems. And so we're putting money towards that so that we can monitor the weather in various areas that we know are prone to Santa Ana wind conditions like this. But proactively, we are going out and educating the public. We know that what occurred in the Palisades fire could happen in other areas of the city of Los Angeles. If you were to take a look at Brentwood, Bel Air, You take a look at the Hollywood Hills. You take a look at various wildland urban interface areas within the city of Los Angeles. We are very, very concerned about the amount of vegetation we have and the lack of home hardening. So we're taking a proactive approach in educating the public. And we think it's extremely important that people not only prepare themselves for another wildfire, potential wildfire event, but also the event of an earthquake. We know if people aren't prepared for such things as wildfires, they're probably not prepared for earthquakes. And so we are doing everything we can through the city of Los Angeles to educate people on how to properly prepare their homes, how to have safe evacuation routes, more than one, from evacuating their home, what it means to shelter in place, what it means to evacuate when they have to evacuate. And we've actually taken proactive measures by working with our law enforcement partners and implementing Genesis Protect, which is a software system that allows us to make faster evacuations, identify the areas that need to be evacuated, communicate to the public quickly, and allow them the opportunity to be able to evacuate or shelter in place, whichever is necessary. We've taken proactive measures in going to neighborhood council meetings and community group meetings to educate the public on home hardening, materials they should use to protect their house, and what it means to create defensible space.
Chief Garcia, I know that there were not necessarily any after-action reports on the federal side, but were there any lessons learned for your agency?
Sure, yeah. So we did have participation in the FSRI reviews that you've already read, that phase one, as far as our initial attack commanders participated in those in that forum. But, you know, we definitely strive to be a learning organization, and that occurs at all levels of our organization. You know, what we've described in our experiences today, most of us typically can probably pick out one or two big events from our career. It was like the career event. But then you think about the last 10 years, and we've had career events like every other year. And generational fires, if you will, big fire sieges that we can kind of cite back and maybe in terms of decades. So we take a look at all aspects of this thing. And you know, I know in our local relationships that we have, as far as our mutual aid systems, our adaptations in our mutual aid zones are all the result of every year we take a look at, you know, where can we make adjustments? Where can we provide better mutual aid or move boundaries or radio frequencies? And the scale of what we're talking about from January is way beyond what is kind of perceived as normal. So I think, you know, so my big takeaways is really some lessons relearned that transcend through another generation of firefighters and up and coming leaders in our organization. And that's that we have systems and procedures and agreements, but what makes all that work is the relationships that our commanders and our firefighters have that they develop throughout the years. From a larger scale of our organization, the fire year, Chief Todd was talking about seasonality and things like that, is we continue to try to adapt our system to deal with what we're facing today relative to what we have the last couple decades in terms of staffing, in terms of support. Our system is largely geared towards the fire season in the West, which has traditionally been a much smaller period. So being able to respond the way we would in August, in January or December, with all the things, you know, we talk about fire engines and helicopters, but what makes much of that successful after the first 24 hours is catering support and logistical support and ground-based type of support for all those assets. So we've had a lot of conversation with our organization on how to make that system more robust to meet our needs in the longer part of the year. And then on the technology side, a lot of what's been kind of already discussed, but thinking about technology in a way that we think about radio frequencies and plumbing, and that's interoperability. How do we take all of the tools that all of our agencies bring to bear and make them integrated and interoperable when we're moving resources across the state, across our local jurisdictions? And so I think about all the new solutions that have come into the wildland fire arena, from intelligence gathering, common operating picture, and how do we ensure that we make all those things interoperable, interchangeable, depending on the color of the truck and the patch.
Excellent. Chief Tyler.
So we recognize going back to some of the basics, and that is a reiteration to our firefighters of the importance of just the solid work that we're doing on the ground to make sure that our fires are contained and controlled. Doesn't matter where in the state of California that occurs. You know, as I talked about earlier, it's important to recognize that we need to continue to improve what historically CAL FIRE has been largely a seasonal organization to more of a year-round organization based on the fire year. Right now, I am funded for 65 fire engines at base staffing. That's a minimum of our state engines. Our hope as we continue to improve our staffing in the next year, we should be at anywhere between 153 and 179 of our 356 engines staffed year-round. We recognize that that we need to find ways that while we are integrated through agreements and we have preseason meetings, that there is a need to be able to communicate and order resources better. You heard Chief Maroney talk about Chief Crowley in the first day of the Palisades fire of sending a text message, and that is an effective way of the chief officers in Southern California to be able to start moving resources rapidly. But we recognize that when we're pulling resources from all over the state of California and outside the state, I talked about the coordination centers in Redding and Riverside, but we can refine that and we can do better. And so as a result of that, we're commissioned to create a work group at the local, state, and federal level to talk about what are the barriers and what are the obstacles of Chief Moore being able to hit regional and statewide resources more rapidly. And so there are groups that are trying to find those obstacles and barriers and start removing those for us as well. We recognize that the Fire Safety Research Institute, as you said, is still awaiting that final report. That is the same agency that did the report in Maui. So there is a lot of independent credibility there that's really going to be able to take a look at all of our actions. We recognize through agreements that that while we have these local agreements across the state, that accessing those out-of-state resources more rapidly is important as well. So here in just the last few months, we entered into what we call the Northwest Compact, is a forest agency, forest firefighting compact with other states across the West, which then tag on to states across the nation that allow us to order directly with them in state-to-state agreements and start moving their resources more quickly. We find a need that I think is a positive over the years is the integration that we're doing, and I'll use the Eaton Fire as an example. In the Eaton Fire, you had the unified command, as Chief Maroney talked about earlier. But then there was a support network of incident management teams, subject matter experts in their areas or their craft that come in and support the agencies having jurisdiction. Now, in the Eaton Fire, we had a Los Angeles County Fire Department local team. We had a interagency United States Forest Service team, and we had a CAL FIRE incident management team all working at the Rose Bowl on the Eaton Fire at the same time to be able to support the agencies. In the Palisades, we were able to support Los Angeles Fire Department with another incident management team to support and help prop them up and support them where they need to. And so continuing to build on that unified command structure is going to be important for us. It's important, as I know that it's very near and dear to the media, is that we continue to educate on allowing media access in and through roadblocks and concerned areas for transparency, and we will do better there as well. We continue to invest in technology. We've talked a lot about that, whether it be fire detection cameras on mountaintops using artificial intelligence, whether it be our wildfire threat intelligence and integration center is a hub in Sacramento that's drawing technology from all over the place to be able to provide that out into the field, whether it be fixed wing aircraft that are flying high altitudes above incidents, giving decision makers real-time or near real-time perimeters of where the fire activity is occurring, and where technology is going, whether it be through the use of drones or even through initiatives through the Earth Fire Alliance that is looking at things like what's called FireSat. FireSat is satellite systems over the top of the state of California that will in the absence of fixed-wing aircraft, we'll start providing perimeters to decision makers on the ground. That is in the early stages. They hope to have over 50 satellites across the state in the coming years. Right now, they have three. But all the other chiefs have hit on this as well. It is important to reinforce our community education. And while evacuations are the primary responsibility of our fire law enforcement partners, we recognize that our firefighters on the ground are in the first hours of an emergency or assisting law enforcement in evacuations. So instead of fighting the fires or their sole responsibility of fighting the fires, they are doing life safety. They are rescuing people and removing them from the emergency. We need to recognize and will recognize that the prevention efforts that we are doing and the prevention efforts that we continue to do as across the state, not just Cal Fire, whether it be home hardening and the importance of home hardening, whether it be fuels reduction and the work of removing the vegetation on the ground to increase the protection of our local communities and the impacts to our local communities, whether it be utilizing... Not necessarily, you know, there's a lot of discussion in Southern California about beneficial fire, but across the north, utilizing beneficial fire or managed fire to reduce the vegetation on the ground are all important. You know, we went through January and had this devastating, catastrophic event on the community. And yet we talk about home hardening and we talk about things like Zone Zero. And Zone Zero will be something that will be coming forward in various shapes and ways. But it is important to recognize that as these initiatives continue to move forward, that your home can still look beautiful without vegetation right up against the side of it. And there will be lots of discussions about what that's going to look like in the future. That's above any of our agencies that are sitting in this room. But what we care about is that your home is hardened and that the home can sustain these catastrophic events.
Chief Maroney.
Yeah, thank you. I think what it all comes down to is better coordination and communication between our public safety partners, the communities we protect, right down to individual residents. Because I think that we've already explained we don't have enough resources in California to address three simultaneous fires like we experienced on January 7th, that our residents play a big part in keeping their homes safe and themselves safe. Like Chief Tyler said, better fuels and forest management, good defensible space, and home hardening with some aspect of Zone Zero, so no combustibles within 5 feet of a structure. I think that's really going to help. The McChrystal Group came out with their report on alert notification systems and evacuation policies in September. There were 5 focus areas and 15 action items. And the LA County Fire Department, under my leadership, is going to be dedicated to implementing all of those improvements, so we're certain to do better in the future, because risks are increasing. I believe it's due to the changing climate. Like I said, over the past 11 years, we've had our most damaging, destructive, life-loss fires. And that's throughout our 102-year recorded history. We are leveraging technology. We are going to get a new computer-aided dispatch system. We're hiring more firefighters and captains. I have tremendous support from our LA County Board of Supervisors to increase our staffing, to be better prepared. We're purchasing new apparatus, and we're working with the LA County Sheriff's Department to help be better at wildfire evacuations. We're updating our policies, we're deconflicting them, we're establishing new policies. But like I said, we're leveraging technology, and like Chief Tyler said, we have FireGuard, the FireGuard satellite system, to help us do firefront following. We're also looking at Oratech, in addition to FireSat, for that fire front following and for spot fire detection, which is so important. That's what we didn't have at the Eaton fire. So we're going to just continue to work to be better, but we really have to engage the community to help us, because we've realized that no fire department stands alone in time of a crisis. We all rely on one another. We participate in the state's Master Mutual Aid program. We send LA County firefighters out of LA County to the north every year. And I'm just so appreciative to my public safety partners, that not only the people sitting here today, but all of the fire departments in the Western United States, from as far away as Washington State, that came to our assistance during our darkest hour. And, you know, everything that we do to improve is really going to be done in the memory of the 31 lives lost, because for them and their families, we have to make sure that we improve each and every day.
Let's talk misinformation. It's an open question, and you guys just jump in. Let's talk about some of the biggest myths and misinformation surrounding these fires. A lot's been said about the way it was handled, the way you responded, whether you had control, the pre-deployment, all this stuff. So I'm just putting it out there. This is your opportunity to clear up misinformation and myths.
There's a lot of misinformation that's out there from what happened in regards to the post-Lachman fire. Being the new fire chief, I'm in the learning stages to find out what exactly happened. I'm relying on the after-action review that was done by our agency, as well as the review that was done by FSRI. I have supported Mayor Bass's request for an independent investigation of the Lachman fire, and have reached out to get an RFP done in order to have that fire investigated by an independent investigating source, as well as asked that the FSRI include it as part of the 11 fires that they've already investigated, since it is associated with the Palisades fire. My goal is to determine what happened with that fire. What could we have done better? What lessons learned? And focus on improving the Los Angeles Fire Department from those lessons learned. My goal as the fire chief of the Los Angeles Fire Department is to ensure that the members of the Los Angeles Fire Department have the tools, the equipment, and the training necessary to combat today's wildfire realities. Again, these are unprecedented fires. Do I think this is going to be the last of these fires that we'll ever see? Absolutely not. I just want to make sure that in the future we're prepared for what might come our way. And that includes improving our decision-making, improving our pre-deployment of resources, ensuring that we have the equipment necessary to combat these resources, ensuring that our firefighters have the tools, the equipment, and the staffing necessary to be able to stand up to these types of situations.
So the only misinformation that you know was just the Lachman fire incident. That's the only thing that you're kind of aware of that you want to clarify.
Yeah, well,
I mean, there's a lot out there. There's a lot being said about how things were handled, and I'm just giving you an opportunity to address all of that. And I mean, just look at social media alone. Everyone's kind of assumed they know what should have happened. And they know what went on.
I'll touch on one aspect, you know, and it's kind of maybe a larger picture, but, you know, there's a lot of focus on the natural environment. We're talking a lot about the built environment, the conditions that led to the outcome that we face today. And I point that out because I think it's a complex system that led to the risk and then the ultimate outcome. And oftentimes we're looking for a simple single point failure in a system. And so when I look at how we approach fuels management and forest management in the context of Eaton and other incidents where we're engaged, areas where it would help, yes, but that's a simplified version of what do we need to do, right?
Sure.
And so that's definitely one area where, yes, absolutely more risk reduction to provide resilience. And then I guess the other piece is looking at the severity and the scale and the resilience of our communities. and also our organizations. What we're talking about is our careers, those career events that we probably can reference where our firefighters today are facing those, what we would define as a career event every other year. And how do we kind of approach like what the outcome is for how this impacts, it's been touched on earlier, but the bravery and the work our firefighters did on January 7th and how those types of events really in the long term, as they face those almost year after year in different parts of the state, the impact there.
Let me rephrase the question then, since that didn't spark any, apparently you guys are okay. Oh, you do have, you got some stuff. Okay, jump in. Because what I was going to ask you then is complete this question. I really wish the public knew blank. Which version of this question do you want? The misinformation or I really wish the public knew blank?
Now, let me jump on just a few of these. We hit on a couple of them already. Myth. That leaders purposefully let the fires burn. There is no fire chief sitting in this room or outside of this room, across the state, across the nation, that would purposefully let a fire burn. And there is no firefighter on the ground that would purposely let a fire burn. I hit earlier the inspection of apparatus moving into the state. Yes, that occurred. Yes, it was for the firefighter's safety. And yes, they were not there for more than 30 minutes at a time before they continued south. Incident management teams from CAL FIRE were brought across the state to support Los Angeles County Fire Department, Los Angeles Fire Department, United States Forest Service. It's part of our mutual aid system. There are questions about why there were no fire engines sitting on every block. There are not enough fire engines to sit on every block. There are not enough fire engines to sit in every home. I described earlier the system across California, paid professional in the South, largely volunteer in the North. So if you call up a Northern California volunteer fire department to come to Southern California, it is going to take them 1 to 4 hours to deploy, to move their fire engines south as a volunteer fire department, and then it's going to take them 12 to 16 hours to drive to Southern California. The resources are not going to be there in the initial attack phase of the fire. The last item that I'll leave you with is a lot of criticism across the state when people would say there is devastation occurring in Southern California and yet there's a fire engine sitting in the fire station. This is a hard decision of every fire chief across the state, across the nation, that they still have the jurisdictional responsibility to protect their citizens from other emergencies, such as traffic accidents, hazardous material spills, medical aids, and other structure fire type incidents in their jurisdiction. So yes, there will unfortunately be times that not every resource in the state of California can deploy to a wildland fire.
Yeah, and I want your listeners to know that the LA County Fire Department and the overall incident, we did not abandon Altadena, Malibu, Big Rock, or Sunset Mesa. We simply ran out of resources and personnel. We also had challenges with the domestic water system being able to supply firefighting water for multiple hours into the incident. And I want your listeners to know that neither myself nor any of the unified incident commanders gave any stand down orders to let homes burn. The fire department responds to wildfires to do three primary functions: to do perimeter control, structure defense, and to rescue people who can't get out of harm's way, who can't self-evacuate. Like Chief Tyler said, law enforcement has the responsibility for evacuations. That's codified in the penal code. But the fire department assists in rescuing people who can't get out of harm's way. So we really go to the fire. Number one is to fight the fire, to defend people's structures and do perimeter control. But also, we're always going to prioritize life over property. So if we're in rescue mode and we're assisting our law enforcement partners with evacuations, that is more important than defending people's homes. We expect that people will leave when they get the evacuation order. We'd recommend that people prepare to leave during the evacuation warning. And we're going to do our very best to protect lives, property, and the environment for every incident we respond to. But we did not abandon any community, and we did not provide any stand-down order to let homes burn.
Steve, if I can address something real quick, and I was hesitant to address this only because it's been misinterpreted in the past. There's been a lot of misinformation in regards to text messages that were allegedly sent on the fire ground of the Lockman fire. That fire is being investigated by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They do have a person in custody for that fire. Because of these allegations, the ATF has subpoenaed cell phone records, text message records from members of the Los Angeles Fire Department. When I first became fire chief, when I was first appointed fire chief of the Los Angeles Fire Department, I came out and made the statement that I've yet to see those text messages. And I have still yet to see those text messages. And the only reason I said that is because, to me, it would really help me to understand the situation and better understand the situation as to why firefighters would have text messaged something as critical, such critical information as the fire is not out, why are we picking up the hose and why are we leaving? And the reason why is because I would want to hold whoever was responsible for making the decision, having been given that information, accountable for making such a decision. I have also said since the very beginning, not having seen those text messages, I have to treat them as if they really did happen. And I have to be concerned about that. And that's why I am ensuring that we have a very thorough mop-up policy that would address those type of situations so that it would never happen again. I also want to improve the transparency and improve the trust amongst our organization so that our members, if they ever did find themselves in a situation where they felt that they were being told to do something that was so critical that could lead to such a event as what's been determined as this holdover fire, this fire that was burning deep in the earth that led to the Palisades fire. If they had that information, they got to trust that they can give it to somebody and that somebody's going to take action on that. So I want to just address those text messages, and I'm taking them as if they really did happen, and I'm taking action to make sure that we address that in the future. The other thing is our water supply. That wasn't unique to the city of Los Angeles when you have water supply issues under that type of demand. We had almost 7,000 structures that were burning, and there was not enough water to be able to suppress the type of fire conditions that we had. And it's understandable under those situations. So what are we doing now is we are making sure that we've ensured that our firefighters have other ways to augment their water supply. We're working with the city of Los Angeles to make sure that we have water tenders. God forbid we ever have such a situation again, that we could have additional water available to us. And we are working with DWP to ensure that as the Palisades rebuilds, that it's going to be rebuilt as a resilient, safe community, that the construction is safe for the environment, and that the water supply is sufficient for the demands of that community as well.
Final thoughts. Your final message to those that were impacted by the fires?
Yeah, just add that, the significant challenges that we all face as agency partners and lots of lessons to learn in all aspects of this. And we should take a deep dive into all aspects, whether it's technology, how we mobilize, and we will. You know, I think the agencies are committed to always improving. If you look at how we've evolved some of these systems from tragedies such as this. And at the same time, I am proud of our firefighters and our partners for the critical decisions made before the first fire, during the fires, and after the fires all the way to through now. Many of those decisions were unconventional on the fly. Some of them were described here that were critical to the success of those operational successes that we did have despite the tragic losses and ultimate outcome of the incident.
Chief Tyler, final message to the survivors.
On behalf of the women and men of CAL FIRE, it is important that we recognize both the loss of those who perished in these fires, as well as those that are still rebuilding and surviving from these fires, It is not the first fire, and it will not be the last. And so where we find ourselves now is the importance of remembering those that were lost and those that are surviving this and how we can continue to do things better. It's important to ensure that just because we had fires in the Palisades and the Eaton and the several other fires across the Los Angeles region, that people continue to sign up for alert and warnings across their regions, that they sign up for local information from their fire service organizations, that they can go to places like Cal Fire and find information on improving home hardening and defensible space, or the Ready, Set, Go program at readyforwildfire.org, all ways that we can prepare ourselves into the future. We will learn even more from the devastating effects of January 2025 as we move forward.
Well, on behalf of the Los Angeles City Fire Department, they will be in our thoughts, especially during this time of, you know, January, when we remember the lives that we've affected. There were over 6,800 structures that were burned, 12 lives that were lost, families that have been impacted. Many of those families are still out of their homes, and we are committing ourselves to ensure that we help the Palisades rebuild a stronger, safer community. Our firefighters are dedicated to ensure that we provide the resources that they need, and we don't ever want this to ever happen again, and we'll be there for them in the future.
Chief Maroney.
Yeah, on behalf of all the members of the LA County Fire Department, our thoughts and prayers remain with all the families who lost loved ones, the 31 people who perished during this community conflagration, and also all of those people who lost their homes, businesses, who were displaced. We're keeping those people in our thoughts and prayers. As they recover and rebuild, it's our priority to make sure that we're there to support them in standing their lives back up. And all of the changes that we are going to implement, it's my commitment to them that we are going to implement all of the recommended changes to be better in the future. Because like Chief Tyler said, we're going to have more fires and we have to be ready. But we need to focus more not only on the response, but on the preparedness and the preparation, the tough work that we have to do to be better prepared for the next time.
Gentlemen, we could go on. There's a lot here. There's a lot to still unpack on this, but your time is limited, and I certainly appreciate the time you spent with us today. So thanks again for your insights, and thanks again for being so candid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of the LA Local for January 7th, 2026, brought to you by the LA Car Guy family of dealerships. You can see the inventory for all 12 dealerships at lacarguy.com. I'm Steve Gregory, KNX News 97.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. And one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter. From plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well. Hire high-quality pros at Angie.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no. so my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron in Santa Fe to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark-colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.
Thy ticket, Lady Jennifer of Coolidge.
Well, many thanks, good sir. Heareth my Discover card.
They accept Discover at Renaissance fairs?
Yeah, they do here. Discover is accepted at the places I love to shop. Getteth with the times.
With the times?
You're playing the lute. Yeah, and it sounds pretty good, right?
Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. Based on the February 2025 Nielsen report.
It's a new year, and it's time to get your picks in 26 with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop Bob's for hot new styles featuring the latest technology, like stylish sleeper sectionals with immersive Bluetooth audio, relaxing reclining sofas with LED lighting, and fabulous fireplaces with mood lighting and speakers, all at Bob's everyday low prices, of course. So if you want to refresh your room for less, save big by stopping in or shopping online at Bob's Discount Furniture.